the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Good morning and welcome to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. We're grateful for the lawyers and welcome them here to argue this case. We're also happy to welcome the public at large who may be listening on an audio cue that is available for you. Mr. McSweeney, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. The court should reverse the decision below because the decision was based upon an unconstitutional enactment of the General Assembly, which had not yet been signed by the governor. And the court also improperly relied on, testimony of experts about public policy. And to the extent he relied on separate legislative actions unrelated to the Lee Monument, his decision was in error. And ultimately, the restrictive covenants that we rely on are and were valid and enforceable. And let me speak specifically to the point we raised about Article 4, Section 14, Paragraph 2, which provides that the General Assembly shall not, by special legislation, grant relief in these and other cases of which the courts or other tribunals may have jurisdiction. There's no question in view of what this court has said about legislation that is directed at a single object that this is special legislation. The question is whether it grants relief. In that respect, we rely on Mr. Hyten's own words. On page 4 of our reply, we quote two of those. And in the argument, he also says the rulings below, beg your pardon, he said legislation, the budget amendment, which was enacted at the special session shortly before the trial in this case, authorizes the precise thing the plaintiffs are asking this court to stop. That's in addition to his statements that we quoted on page 4 of our reply. We think it absolutely dispositive of this case. And in addition, he says, we think the budget amendment just ends this case in our favor. I think the very language used by Mr. Hytens is conclusively establishing the fact that this grants relief in this case. We also raised other objections to the constitutionality of this budget amendment, one of which was the contract clause, both of the Virginia Constitution, Article 1, Section 11, and the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10. Rule 5:17 provides that assignments are appropriate regarding any rulings below or issues on which the tribunal or court appeal from failed to rule. Mr. Hyten suggests that because the court did not rule on it, it's not before this court. Clearly, the language in Rule 5:17 disputes that and puts an end to that argument. The contract clause has been applied by this court, and it's interesting that the language used by this court about the types of actions by the General Assembly that can invalidate contracts are not just any action that is appropriate otherwise legitimate exercises of the police power or the sovereign power, but only those that are the exercises of the essential power of the Commonwealth. We've cited two cases in particular, the Spanos case, the Allied Structured Corporation versus Spanos, that's a Supreme Court case, and the decision in this case, this court in Citizen Mutual Building Association. Both of those deal with the exercise of substantial power by the General Assembly. And yet those, in both instances, actually in Allied, in Spanhouse, it was Congress. But in both, the actions were invalidated by the court as violating the contract clause. Mr. Hyten's argument that the General Assembly has plenary power is obviously cabined by specific provisions of the Constitution, particularly the contract clause in this case. Article 4, Section 14, Paragraph 2 is another, and the separation of powers. It does not exercise the right and the power to invalidate contracts in every exercise in what would otherwise be a legitimate exercise of police power or sovereign power. In the Hublin case that we've cited, Supreme Court, this court said that it's only in the exceptional cases, and not in every case, which would otherwise be lawful, a lawful exercise of the General Assembly's power. It is significant that there is a theme in both contract clause, Article 4, Section 14, and in the separation of powers cases, that only general laws, only laws that have general applicability, can invalidate contracts or grant relief. This case clearly involves a special law. In each of those instances, therefore, both in the separation of powers context, Article 4, Section 14, and the contract clause context, special laws cannot invalidate the restrictive covenants, which in this case are clearly involve contracts. Despite the fact that it was not raised below, Mr. Hyten argues on appeal that these were not contracts. Well, obviously, this court in several cases, the Sloan case we've cited, Sonoma, and RACP, those cases, including the 19th century case, the decision in Tardy, all involved deeds that also involved contractual obligations. The contract clause plainly applies in review of these, of the action by the General Assembly in the budget amendment that attempted to grant relief in this case and invalidate or abrogate the restrictive covenants. The court below recognized explicitly and repeatedly that only the General Assembly establishes public policy. And yet he relied on the budget amendment, which had not yet been enacted, and which we contend is unconstitutional. A series of separate actions by the General Assembly and others to establish public policy, and on the testimony of experts who cannot establish or even contribute to the understanding of what is public policy in the Commonwealth. That's either the General Assembly adopts and establishes that policy, or it does not. We've also relied on the decisions in Ault v. Shipley and the RECP case, which say that, now they did deal, both of them, with legislative actions of local governing bodies in adopting zoning amendments. The court said that even that legislative power cannot override or abrogate a restrictive covenant. That is a narrower theory than the contract clause theory, and certainly is quite different from the Article 4, Section 14 argument we've made, that the action of the General Assembly in enacting the budget amendment cannot override or abrogate the restrictive covenants in this case. We have gone to great length, and the court agreed with us below that the language of the covenants were not ambiguous, were not vague, and they were enforceable. The only reason that the court ruled to the contrary was the budget amendment. It is difficult to review the case without seeing that the other argument made by the Commonwealth, that there were changed conditions, relate to anything other than changes in public policy. No specific evidence was ever produced showing a change in the conditions in this subdivision or any change affecting the original purpose of these restrictive covenants. The change of circumstances, the test applied by this court consistently since the Booker decision and even earlier, but of the kind of changes that are involved to use that basis for invalidating restrictive covenants are best identified in cases like Chesterfield Meadows Shopping Center, that's the 264 Virginia 350, and in River Heights, which we cited in the brief, 267 Virginia 262. We don't have those kinds of changes. What we're talking about in this case is whether public policy had been changed, and it can only change by legitimate action, constitutional action of the General Assembly, which we maintain was not involved in this action by the General Assembly in a special session. I would like, if possible, to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
9 minutes, 10 seconds. Mr. Heidens, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Toby Heidens, and along with Attorney General Mark Herring, I represent the appellees in this matter. 1 year and 4 days ago today, the governor of Virginia decided that Commonwealth statute would be relocated one Commonwealth ownership to another. The General Assembly has agreed. That should have been the end of the matter. I think it's critically important not to lose sight of what issue is before the court here this morning. This case is not about whether the people of 1890 had the power to put this statue up, or about whether the people of 1890 to 2020 had the power to leave it up. This case is about whether a handful of private individuals possess a judicially enforceable right to override the decision of the Commonwealth's political branches and the will of many of their own neighbors to force the Commonwealth of today and tomorrow to continue to maintain this statue indefinitely. Plaintiffs have cited no decision where any court has ever recognized that sort of extraordinary private right against the sovereign itself. And there's a very good reason for that. Plaintiffs' claims in this case are not merely undemocratic. They are actively opposed to the concept of representative democracy itself. I know there are a lot of moving parts in these cases, and so what I want to do in my remaining time is to focus on what I think are the two most straightforward ways of this court to resolve these cases. First, the court could follow the approach taken by the circuit court in Taylor and hold that regardless of whether plaintiffs ever had any sort of enforceable property right, that right was extinguished by the 2020 law, and that law is perfectly constitutional. Option two, the court could hold that the sort of novel and unprecedented property right asserted by the plaintiffs in these cases simply is not recognized under the law of the Commonwealth of Virginia and never has been. If the court were to do that, there would be no need to reach any issues involving the 2020 law, and both decisions could be affirmed on that basis alone. Put another way, Your Honor, there are two entirely separate ways of resolving these cases. The Commonwealth only needs to win once, and plaintiffs need to win both times. I have one last point to make, and that is about this court's ultimate disposition of these cases. As of today, June 8th, 2021, the governor has been enjoined from acting for an entire year as of today, despite having prevailed on the merits in every single challenge seeking to block his actions. For that reason, I think it is critically important that the court not only affirm the circuit court's decision on merits, but also to make clear that the injunction pending appeal is immediately dissolved, and that the new status quo is that the governor may act unless plaintiffs succeed in obtaining a new injunction from this court or a higher. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. McSweeney, rebuttal?
To address the first option, which is that the action of the General Assembly, which is necessary in this case to override or abrogate these restrictive covenants, was constitutional. There could be no clear case involving Article 4, Section 14, Paragraph 2 than this case, by Mr. Hyten's own words. What the General Assembly attempted to do was grant relief, dispositive action involving the issues in this case. Recall that we filed asking, challenging the governor's order to remove. The governor's relief was to block that by having the court order that it could be removed. Removal was the issue, and that is specifically what the General Assembly addressed. It even used the term removal. There's no question it was special legislation. The argument that rational basis test applies to a situation like this, where only a single object was involved, would completely eviscerate Article 4, Section 14. It says what it says, it means what it means, which is that when you address a single object, it is special legislation. There was no classification involved here. Now, whether it granted relief is clearly what Mr. Hyten's was asking the circuit court to do, apply the language of the budget amendment to dispose of this case, which is what the court did. Under the contract clause, I mentioned earlier the Hebline decision, where the court said the contract clause does impose some limits upon the state's power to abridge existing contracts in the exercise of its otherwise legitimate public powers. Obviously, the General Assembly has broad plenary powers. They are constrained and limited by specific provisions of the federal and state constitution, which the Commonwealth simply ignores. Let me turn to option two. We cited the leading case, which this court has repeatedly relied upon, cited with approval. That's the Tulk case from the UK. There's no question that the language used in this case in the restrictive covenants is remarkably similar to the covenants involved in that case, which involved an equestrian statue that was to be maintained and left as it was erected. There could be no closer parallel than the Tulk facts and the facts in this case. The Commonwealth and the law professors who filed an amicus brief simply ignore that decision. We gave you the instances in which this court has acknowledged the continuing vitality of that Tulk ruling. This is not a novel, ambiguous, or vague description of what is to be done under the restrictive covenant. It is well established in the Commonwealth. That restrictive covenant is valid and enforceable. Now, if the General Assembly is to be allowed to change its attitude about commitments made, for example, under Section 10.1-1010, which establishes the conservation easement program in Virginia, conservation easements are perpetual, but they're also subject to the same limitations that apply here. Change conditions and a change in the General Assembly's public policy. But if that change in public policy is simply a change in the attitude, it would cast doubt on virtually every obligation the Commonwealth enters. I think this case has broader implications than the facts of these particular restrictive covenants. We urge the court to reverse the decision below, which was plainly in violation. It clearly ignored the constitutional violations when the General Assembly enacted the special legislation. at the 2020 special session and rule that these covenants are valid and enforceable. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Are there any questions from the court? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Hyde.